Now begins Unit 4. And for the rest of the term, in one way or another, we're going to be dealing with DNA. Not so directly in this chapter, but still it is involved. The first chapter of the unit is called the cell cycle. And it really is involved in this. The cell cycle refers basically to a lifetime of a cell, but a cell can be killed, of course. If it doesn't get killed, it doesn't die, then its own lifetime as a single cell really occurs when it splits to create two new cells. That's true whether it's a free-living cell or whether it's just one of trillions of cells in you, for instance. An individual cell can split to create two new cells. And that's part of cell theory. We've talked about this before, right? Cells don't just pop into existence anymore. Cells come from pre-existing cells. So we'll talk about how that happens in this chapter. In the opening slide, though, we can see three major reasons that cells undergo cell division, one of which is reproduction. Now, if you are a unicellular organism, then you reproduce by cell division, and that's a little bit different from reproduction of a human, for instance. You know, when a woman gives birth, usually, not always, but usually she survives that process. The mother still exists. But a single cell, when it reproduces, it produces two offspring, two brand new cells, and the original cell doesn't exist anymore. But and that of course involves cell division. Cell division, though, is involved even in multicellular reproduction, though, right? We start out as a single celled zygote, and then we become an embryo by cell division, by creation of new cells. Growth and development are two different things, but they're lumped together here. Growth, of course, refers to increase in size. And we've talked before in a different chapter about why cells are not exactly the same size no matter what organism you look at, but there's not a huge range in size of cells, right? They're all roughly the same size, and that's because it's impossible for a cell to be indefinitely large in all three dimensions. What is the constraint that is put on cell size? Why can't you have a cell as big as you want it to be? There it is. What kind of ratio? What is the ratio that constrains cell size? It's the surface area to volume ratio. If a cell gets big in all three dimensions at once, eventually its volume will outgrow its surface, and that surface won't be enough to allow for enough exchange to service that volume. So that means for growth of a multicellular organism like us, we get big not by growing our cells big, but by adding a bunch of cells to our body. And that involves cell division to create those new cells. Development refers to the fact that although we are trillions of cells, those trillions of cells that make up the human body are not just 100 trillion copies of the zygote we started as. We have different kinds of cells because we develop along the way. So the cells specialize for different jobs. There are neurons, hepatocytes, and so on that make up the body. Tissue renewal is another reason we have cell division. Now, this, of course, refers only to multicellular organisms. Tissues is one level in that hierarchy of biological organization that we looked at in the first chapter, I think it was, first chapter of the term, right, where you go from molecules all the way up to the biosphere. Tissues, you don't find tissues in a unicellular organism. It's above the level of cells, right? Cells make up tissues. Tissues make up organs and so on. Tissues get damaged, though. You know, whether you cut your skin or whatever damage, or whether there's death of cells in tissues, those need to be repaired. And that, of course, involves creating new cells to replace the ones that died, and that, once again, involves cell division. So those are three major reasons why we create cells via cell division. Let's look at number two, the photomicrograph that we're looking at here is a cell. You've probably guessed that. But in the dichotomy of cell types, what kind of cell is this? It is eukaryotic. And how do you know that just from looking at it? Right. This is a pretty distinct nucleus, right? Separate from the rest of the cell. So only eukaryotic cells have true nuclei, right, by definition. Yes, this region that has the darker purple stuff in it is the nucleus. And that darker purple stuff that is in the nucleus, get a pen, is a material called chromatin. Chromatin... Is this dark enough? Even in the back? Okay. Chromatin, molecularly speaking, is a mixture of DNA, which of course is a nucleic acid, right? That's one of the four classes of macromolecules. So chromatin has DNA, but it also has proteins, which is another category of macromolecules. And that overall mixture is called chromatin. Chromatin is the stuff, the material, that chromosomes are made out of. And I'm sure you've heard of chromosomes. We're going to be talking a lot more about them from here on out. But this stuff that you see here in the nucleus, even though it's the material for chromosomes, and there's not going to be any more material added, so all the stuff is there for chromosomes, we don't actually call what you're looking at here chromosomes yet, even though it's still the same stuff. And that's because until this chromatin condenses, gets more compact to the point that we actually see individual pieces, which you don't hear, right? You can't tell how many pieces there are here. Until it gets to that compactness, we just call it chromatin. Once we see individual pieces with individual shapes, then we call those things chromosomes. So it's a bit of a word game, but that's the difference between those words. And this cell is not only obviously eukaryotic because we see the nucleus, but I can also tell just by looking at this that this cell is about to end its own lifetime. It's getting close to the end of the cell cycle, which is the main focus of the chapter. One cell cycle is the time between the creation of a cell and then the end of its own lifetime when it splits to create two new cells. In other words, this cell, I can tell by looking at, is getting ready to split. And that's why the chromatin that you see here is starting to condense. Now, earlier in the cell cycle, when this cell was just busy being whatever kind of cell it is, you would see the nucleus, but it would kind of just look gray. And that's because the chromatin that's there, which contains all the DNA and therefore all the genes, because genes are part of DNA, it would be real diffuse, not compacted. And that's important because, well, let's review the two major functions of DNA. We also talked about this at the beginning of the term. DNA has two major functions in organisms. What are those?
Transcription.
Yes. Transcription. And what?
Replication.
And replication, yes. Now, one of those jobs, transcription, is all about what DNA does during the normal lifetime of a cell. Transcription is when genes are used, right? Genes are read during transcription to produce RNA, which then can be read by the cell to produce proteins. So to do that, the DNA has to be loose. It can't be very compacted. Otherwise, you can't read the codes. So during the normal lifetime of a cell, when it's busy being whatever kind of cell it is, it needs its DNA library so that it can transcribe those genes for the ultimate purpose of producing the proteins that those genes stand for. Because it's the proteins that do the jobs, right? So it needs an accessible library. When it gets time for the cell to end its own lifetime and split into two new cells, it needs to manage this huge, what otherwise would be a tangle of DNA. And it does that by compacting the chromatin it's made out of very densely. And that's what's starting to happen here. It's going to be compacted a lot more until eventually we'll see individual chromosomes. But that's why I can tell this is near the end of the cell cycle. By the way, the other function of DNA, replication, is not really about the lifetime of that cell. That's a function of DNA that's all about a cell ending its own lifetime and creating two new cells, right? Because you need replication to create a copy of DNA in addition to the one that the cell already had originally, so that there is a complete copy for each of the two cells it splits into. Okay, slide 3. This black and white photograph is a single chromosome, one of several that can be in a cell. And there is no there's no definite number in general for how many chromosomes, because that number depends on the species. For any given species, there is a specific normal number of chromosomes, but it just depends on the species. This is one chromosome, though, and you can see now that this is one piece, and if you were looking at the entire set of chromosomes in the nucleus at this point, you would see them distinct from each other, because the chromatin that this chromosome is made out of is very highly compact now, and similarly with all the others. So it doesn't look like just one long tangle. It's gotten so compacted that you see individual bodies. That's when we start calling them chromosomes, when we can tell them apart. Now, this is not only a chromosome. More specifically, it is a replicated chromosome, which means that it's really enough material for two individual chromosomes, one of which will be in each of the two cells that result when the splitting happens. So if you think about this just as a, in common sense terms, if you are a cell and you're about to split into two cells and you want those cells to be viable, which means able to live, then each of those cells not only needs DNA, but each of those cells needs all of the DNA that you had, right? Well, the only way that's going to be possible is if, before splitting, you replicate your DNA so that you have two copies, enough for two cells, and then each cell gets a full library. In other words, you can't just give one cell half of your own DNA and the other cell half of your own, the other half of your own DNA. each of those cells would not be viable because they don't have a full library. So the replication of DNA, which is that second major function, occurs in the cell cycle before this chromatin gets compacted into what are visible chromosomes. All right? Now, in the cartoon form, you have an individual chromosome here that is in compact form. That's really a lie. Because early in the cell cycle, when this is just DNA for one chromosome, and this is an unreplicated chromosome, you wouldn't see it as a chromosome. It would just be loose chromatin. But just for simplicity, they drew it as a compact chromosome, even though that's not how you would see it in a microscope. Then when the cell cycle gets toward the end of the lifetime of this cell, and it prepares to split, it, before this compacting of the chromatin, will replicate all of that DNA that's in the chromatin. And then it will become compacted. And that's when you eventually see however many replicated chromosomes there are for that species. In this pretend species, there's only one chromosome. For humans, there are 23 different kinds of chromosomes. So you would see 23 replicated chromosomes. But that's what this picture is. One replicated chromosome, and you can see that it has two halves to it that are connected together right here. So a replicated chromosome, once again, it's kind of a word game, because we still consider this to be one chromosome, even though it's enough DNA information to be two chromosomes, and it eventually will be two chromosomes. But as long as it's still hooked together, we consider it to be one chromosome, but it's a replicated chromosome. And a replicated chromosome consists of two identical parts, DNA-wise. Remember, the chromatin that it's made out of is DNA and proteins, but the DNA part of that is identical in each half. Each half, by the way, is called a chromatid. So be careful with these words that have similar spellings. Chromatin and chromatid differ by just one letter. Chromatin is the stuff that chromatids are made out of. A chromatid is just one half of a replicated chromosome. And since they are identical to each other because they're part of the same replicated chromosome, they're specifically called sister chromatids. Nothing at all to do with gender, it just, that's the word we use. Okay? The place where these two sister chromatids, which DNA-wise are identical to each other, are connected, holding this thing together still, is called the centromere. Now, in the cartoon, you can see that they're still connected in the middle. But the whole reason that these sister chromatids, that the replication occurred so that there are two sister chromatids that are identical, is in preparation for splitting. And when splitting happens, the chromatids separate and become full chromosomes in their own right, just unreplicated chromosomes, one of which is going to one cell and the other to the other cell. And the original cell no longer exists at that point once the splitting happens. Okay, so the third column here shows you what's happening DNA-wise. Before replication, each chromosome, even though we don't call it a chromosome because it's not yet compacted, consists of one long double helical DNA. And keep in mind that when we say one DNA, that's really two molecules, right? Because each of the halves of the double helix is one polynucleotide. And then the other polynucleotide is held to it by hydrogen bonding. We'll get into that more deeply later. But this is one DNA, and then it gets replicated. There's two DNAs that are identical to each other in a replicated chromosome. and therefore, since the sister chromatids are identical to each other, the two daughter cells, as they're called, are genetically identical to each other. Now, they don't necessarily have identical numbers of mitochondria and everything else, but genetically speaking, their DNA is identical. Okay, now we can look at slide 4, which is a schematic representation of the cell cycle. There's one cell cycle shown here, kind of in clock form. One trip around this circle, in other words, is one cell cycle. And like I said before, a cell cycle begins at cell division, which is when two cells are created. And each of these two cells, of course, goes through its own cell cycle, but we're looking at the cell cycle of just this one cell. That's when it starts, and it will end when that cell splits into two new cells. So all of the time, however long that is, which varies depending on cell type, between the creation of a cell and then the splitting of that cell is one cell cycle. And what you see on the outer band here, which is sort of a teal color and then a yellow color for part of it, what you see by that is that one cell cycle has two major subdivisions. Two phases that make it up, in other words. One of which is interphase, and the other of which is the mitotic phase, or simply the M phase. M stands for mitotic. Now, this is somewhat confusing, the nomenclature here, because mitotic is simply the adjective of mitosis. It means having to do with mitosis. Mitosis itself is one form of eukaryotic cell division. Now, even prokaryotic cells split, but how they split is different from how eukaryotic cells split. Only eukaryotic cells undergo mitosis. And that's because mitosis is defined as the splitting of a cell nucleus and its contents. So therefore, by definition, prokaryotes don't undergo mitosis, right? Because they don't have a nucleus. Otherwise, they wouldn't be a prokaryote. So we'll look at prokaryotic cell division a little bit later in this chapter. But a eukaryotic cell can undergo mitosis. That's one major kind of cell division. And then we'll look at meiosis, which is a different kind, later. Anyway, the confusing part of this is that the mitotic phase includes mitosis, but is more than just mitosis. It's named for the fact that it includes mitosis, but the mitotic phase includes mitosis and cytokinesis. All right, now, I'll get back to this in a second, but since I'm now talking about subdivisions of subdivisions, let's go back to interphase for a second. Interphase is one subdivision of the cell cycle, but then you can subdivide interphase into three major subdivisions. And those, as you see, are G1, S, and G2. G's here, the G's stand for gap. And that's kind of an unfortunate naming too, because gap 1, gap 2 kind of implies that nothing is happening there. Well, that's not true at all. G1, as a matter of fact, the first part of interphase, is the normal lifetime of that cell when it's busy doing whatever that kind of cell does. In other words, in G1, that's when all of the genes that I was talking about earlier need to be accessible. That's why the chromatin is not bunched up into chromosomes during G1, and you wouldn't see it as chromosomes. You would just see the nucleus, and it would look kind of grayish. Because being whatever kind of cell it is, it needs to be able to access those genes, and that's happening during G1. It's just busy being whatever kind of cell it is, living its life. The S phase is named for synthesis. Synthesis specifically of DNA. In other words, creation of new DNA. And this is where replication occurs. Okay, so you have transcription occurring in G1. That's one major job of DNA. And then when you get to the S phase, this cell has already determined that it's lived its life and now it's time to prepare to create two new cells, just like it, genetically identical to itself. And therefore, to do that successfully, you need to replicate the entire DNA library. That's what happens in the S phase of interphase. And that still happens when there is diffuse chromatin. Both of the major jobs of DNA, transcription and replication, require getting in there and reading the sequence of nucleotides that make up the DNA. And you can't do that if the DNA is wound too tightly, like it is in a chromosome. So that's why, even during the S phase, you don't see any chromosomes. But that's when the amount of DNA doubles, because that's when replication occurs. All right. Then you have G2, a second so-called gap phase, but this one isn't really a gap either. There's a lot happening here as well, including more transcription of genes. But this is a later part of the cell's life. It's already made the decision that it's preparing to split. So most of the stuff that's happening in G2 is really all about getting this cell ready to divide. But it's all the preparations that are made after the DNA has already been doubled. Okay, then we get to the mitotic phase, which includes the two subphases, mitosis and cytokinesis. That's when the actual splitting occurs. But if you think back to the major difference, or one major difference between eukaryotic and prokaryotic cells, is that eukaryotic cells are compartmentalized, right? Whereas prokaryotic cells are not. Prokaryotic cells just have one compartment, the cytoplasm, whereas eukaryotic cells are compartmentalized. They have a nucleus, and then everything else is the cytoplasm. And since there are different compartments, when it comes time for a eukaryotic cell to split, it has two separate processes to deal with splitting those compartments separately. In other words, the nucleus splits, and that's what mitosis is. And then the cytoplasm splits. That's what cytokinesis is. Both of those have to occur successfully for the overall cell division to occur successfully. But one of those two processes has to be much more careful than the other. And so which would you say has to be much more careful? The splitting of the nucleus or the splitting of the cytoplasm? The nucleus, right? Because you can't just randomly grab half of the DNA and say, this looks about right. You have to carefully ensure that each of the two daughter cells gets every bit of DNA that the original cell has. Just one copy, not just half of the amount, one copy of the full library, and the other cell has to get the same. Whereas when you're splitting the cytoplasm, you don't have to say, well, it looks like we have 16 mitochondria here. I need to make sure you get 8 and you get 8. That's, the cytoplasm isn't such a big deal about carefully splitting, because you can make the things that you need in the cytoplasm if you have the full DNA library, right? So cytokinesis is a splitting of the cytoplasm. It just doesn't have to be as careful a process as mitosis does. All right, that's one cell cycle. Now let's look more closely at a little bit more than the M phase, the mitotic phase. This is slide 5, and we have colorized photographs on the top of the real stuff happening, but the cartoons corresponding to those photographs are actually easier and more instructive to look at when you're learning this. I said this is a little bit more than the mitotic phase because notice that we're starting off on the left here in G2 of interphase. So that's before the mitotic phase starts. But it's late in interphase, right? The G2 is the last part of interphase before you get to the mitotic phase. And that picture is shown here so that we can compare that to what's happening in the first part and later in mitosis. Now, before I get to that comparison, notice the detail that we didn't see in the previous slide. We just called mitosis a subphase of the mitotic phase. Well, mitosis itself has 5 phases that it's made out of. Okay, so you have the mitotic phase, which includes mitosis and cytokinesis, and then the mitosis itself is further split into 5 phases, and those, as you see, are called prophase, prometaphase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. The last one here, telophase, is listed as telophase and cytokinesis. They're separate, but telophase and cytokinesis are lumped together here because in most cells, cytokinesis starts before mitosis ends, and telophase is the last part of mitosis. They overlap in time, in other words. And by the way, that's kind of represented in the previous slide by the fact that instead of having these stark black lines between mitosis and cytokinesis, it kind of just blends into it. Okay? So mitosis and cytokinesis, or telophase of mitosis, overlaps with cytokinesis in time, but they are distinct in what they're doing because telophase is part of mitosis, therefore it's all about splitting the nucleus, whereas cytokinesis is about splitting all the rest of the cell, the cytoplasm. Okay, so those are the names. Let's see what happens in each of these. But first, let's look at what the state of affairs is before mitosis, late in interphase in G2. This cell has already been through S, remember. So the DNA has already been replicated, and this one cell now has enough DNA for 2 cells. But still, throughout all of this, the chromatin that made it up is loose because it had to be loose to replicate it, and it also has to be loose to read the genes in G2 for transcription. And that's why you can see in the nucleus, you don't see any chromosomes here. You just see chromatin. The nuclear envelope, which of course is the double membrane that surrounds the nucleus, is still intact here, well defined in G2. And also, notice we have 2 centrosomes. Now, I first was talking about these in the tour of the cell chapter, right, when we looked at separate organelles. And that's when I told you that a centrosome, which is kind of this yellow halo, is a microtubule organizing center. And the cartoon cell that we looked at that time had just 1 centrosome. Well, in the S phase, which this has already been through, not only is the DNA replicated in the nucleus, but the centrosome out in the cytoplasm also is replicated. So that's why by the time you get to G2, there are 2 centrosomes. By the way, this particular organism that we're getting these cells from to look at mitosis happens to be an animal, which is why the centrosomes include these licorice-looking T-shaped centrioles that we talked about, the things that we don't really know what they do, but they're part of animal centrosomes, whereas plant cells don't have, they have centrosomes, but they don't have centrioles in their centrosomes. So this is an animal cell. But we have two centrosomes, and notice the centrosomes are right next to each other at this point. Okay, this now let's transition to the first part of mitosis, which is prophase, and look at the difference of compared to G2. Well, one thing that you can see that's pretty obvious is that microtubules are growing out from each of the two centrosomes, which makes sense because centrosomes are microtubule organizing centers. Microtubules themselves are polymers. They're proteins, right? They're part of the cytoskeleton. But they're made by hooking subunits together to get longer and longer. And that's happening from each of these two centrosomes. These long string-like yellow things are microtubules. And as they get longer and longer, as they grow from the centrosomes, they're also kind of interacting with each other, which is causing the two centrosomes that were right next to each other to push away from each other. In other words, to polarize. The centrosomes are polarizing, meaning they're going to opposite ends or poles of the cell. And the two centrosomes plus the microtubules that are growing from them together are making what is called the mitotic spindle. A spindle is something that is tapered at the ends and wider in the middle. Kind of a football shape, in other words. And the mitotic spindle is so called because it's involved in mitosis, but it's spindle-shaped. This isn't as big or as spindle-shaped as it's going to get, but it's you can see that in prophase, the centrosomes are polarizing and the mitotic spindle is beginning to form. That's occurring out in the cytoplasm, which is where the centrosomes are. Let's look inside the nucleus, though. What you see there that's important in prophase is that compared to G2, the chromatin that's in that nucleus is starting to condense, to coil up tighter, and you can start to see what will eventually be chromosomes, but you can't really tell how many there are. You can't tell where one begins, one ends. But it's clearly more condensed than the chromatin that was in G2. The nuclear envelope at this point is also still intact, just like it was in G2. Okay, now let's go to prometaphase. And one big difference between that and prophase is you can see that the polarization of the centrosomes is complete at this point. The centrosomes are on opposite ends of this still single cell. And the mitotic spindle is clearly spindle-shaped, right? Tapered at the ends, football-shaped, in other words. Now, the microtubules that are part of the mitotic spindle are all the same, molecularly speaking. They're all made out of the same monomers to form those long polymers. But there are two functional categories of microtubules in the spindle, even though they're made of the same stuff. And I don't know whether you can read the words from where you are, but those are called kinetochore microtubules for one category, kinetochore microtubules, and the others can either be called non-kinetochore microtubules, which is what this book calls them, or they can be called polar microtubules. Polar and non-kinetochore refer to the same thing. You can use either of those terms. Like I said, they're made of the same stuff, but they're doing different things. That's why they have separate categories. Well, the kinetochore microtubules are named for the fact that what they do is connect to a place on a replicated chromosome called a kinetochore. I'll get back to this, but speaking of chromosomes, look at what has happened here with respect to the condensing of the chromatin. By the time you get to prometaphase, there's much more condensing that has happened, right? And now you can actually see distinct chromosomes. And you can see how many there are. And if you look closely enough, you can even see that each one is replicated. Each chromosome consists of two identical sister chromatids. And remember that that connection point between the two sister chromatids is called the centromere. All right, so you have a centromere represented by basically two black dots on each of these replicated chromosomes. One black dot for each of the two sister chromatids that are stuck together. And that one centromere, that one centromere connection point, has two sides to it, right? One side corresponding to each of the two sister chromatids. And each of those two sides has its own kinetochore, which is a connection point between that replicated chromosome and a kinetochore microtubule, the yellow things. Now, this brings up another important thing that happens during prometaphase. If these kinetochore microtubules are going to connect to the kinetochores, that means you need to get rid of the nuclear envelope. Because the microtubules are part of the mitotic spindle, which is out in the cytoplasm, and the replicated chromosomes are in the nucleus. In other words, the nuclear envelope would be a boundary that would disallow the kinetochore microtubules from connecting to the kinetochores on the replicated chromosomes. You have to get that boundary out of the way. So, you can see that has happened here. In prometaphase, the nuclear envelope that was still intact in prophase has disintegrated. Now, that doesn't make this cell suddenly prokaryotic because it technically doesn't have a nucleus anymore. But it is just one compartment now, and therefore these kinetochore microtubules can make the connection to the kinetochores on the replicated chromosomes. And notice that one kinetochore microtubule from one of the two poles of the spindle is connecting to one kinetochore on one side of the replicated chromosome, and another kinetochore microtubule from the other pole of the spindle is connecting to the other kinetochore on the other side of that same replicated chromosome. And similarly for all the other replicated chromosomes. Or eventually it will be. It's not complete in this picture yet, but that's what's happening. So those are the kinetochore microtubules. Those are some of the yellow strands in this spindle. Notice, though, that there are some that aren't making any connections to the replicated chromosomes. Those are the so-called non-kinetochore microtubules or polar microtubules. Instead, they are interacting with each other. Non-kinetochore microtubules from one pole and non-microtubules from the other pole are pushing on each other as they grow, just like they did when the mitotic spindle was polarizing to begin with. And so not only does that allow for full polarization, but if it continues to happen, it will even make the cell longer, which is part of preparing for dividing into two. So that's the difference between the two categories of microtubules, even though they're made of the same stuff. All right, that brings us to metaphase. And prometaphase simply means before metaphase. Now we're in metaphase. And metaphase is, in terms of the time, the shortest of the phases, Because true metaphase is only the period during which all of the now doubly connected replicated chromosomes appear halfway between the two poles. Notice in prometaphase they were different distances from the poles. Now all of the replicated chromosomes that have made their connections with kinetic or microtubules are halfway between the two poles. Now I intentionally avoided saying lining up. It looks like they're lined up in one line, but this is a two-dimensional image. So if you think of this as three-dimensional, which is in reality, they're all within the same plane between two poles. They're not necessarily in a line. Okay, just like if you cut a globe of the Earth in half, that's with a plane. You can be anywhere in that plane and be halfway between the two poles. And that invisible plane, I mean, it's not actually a structure, but we call that plane the equatorial plate. Not really a thing, but it's just the position that's halfway between the poles. While those replicated chromosomes are halfway there is this metaphase. So that's really what defines metaphase, but another thing that has happened is that the condensing of the chromatin that has gotten these chromosomes to appear originally has continued all throughout these phases. And so these chromosomes in prometaphase are smaller than these because of condensing. Well, by the time you get to metaphase, they're as compact as they're ever going to get. And you can see that they're a little smaller in metaphase here compared to this cartoon. Okay. Anaphase is next, and that is the subphase of mitosis where there's actual splitting occurring. Through metaphase, nothing has split apart, right? But now we are going to split apart in anaphase. The two sister chromatids that make up each replicated chromosome. They're identical to each other, right, as far as the DNA is concerned. Well, the moment this happens, in other words, the moment two sister chromatids are no longer connected to each other, then they aren't referred to as chromatids anymore. Because they were only considered to be chromatids when they were connected to make that replicated chromosome. Once they split, each former chromatid is now a full-fledged chromosome. But notice that it's an unreplicated chromosome that each former chromatid is, because it's just on its own. It's just enough for one cell. And that's why these things are called daughter chromosomes, not daughter chromatids. Okay, so it's, like I said, it's just really a word game. But at this moment, this cell actually has twice as many chromosomes as it did the moment before, even though no material was added or subtracted, simply because we call them chromosomes once they're on their own. And now you can see, though, that this clearly has twice the DNA that it needs to be one cell, which makes sense because it's about to be two cells. You could, hopefully it's clear from the picture that this splitting of the two chromatids to become daughter chromosomes is aided by the fact that earlier on, kinetic or microtubules connected to them. So not only do they split, by the way, the two sister chromatids, but the daughter chromosomes that result from that split start migrating toward one pole or the other, depending on which microtubule they're connected to. In other words, this is a shot in time, but that each group of daughter chromosomes moves closer and closer to its pole. They move away from each other. Okay?
Like this.
Telophase is the final subphase of mitosis. And that's just part of this picture, because like I said, it's combined with cytokinesis. But in telophase, the migrating groups of daughter chromosomes reach the two poles. And where they end up at each pole is the beginning of a new nucleus. So there's going to be a nucleus at each of these two poles form with a new nuclear envelope around each of them. You can see one nucleus here, another nucleus here. Okay, and also notice that immediately, even though this cell has not yet fully split into two, immediately the DNA that's in each new nucleus has started to uncoil so that it can be used for transcription as soon as possible. They're not as condensed anymore. It's going to be just a gray background again pretty soon. Okay, so that's the end of telophase and therefore the end of mitosis, which is all about what's happening at the nucleus. But meanwhile, during that telophase, the cytoplasm also starts to split. And in an animal cell, which is what we're looking at here, that happens by the formation of a cleavage furrow, as it's called. To cleave means to split, and a furrow is just a ditch. So it looks like a ditch has been dug all the way around the equator. And it gets deeper and deeper until it just pinches off, which is not quite shown here, but it's on its way. Once it finally pinches off, that's the end of cytokinesis, and that's the end of that one cell. And it's the creation of two genetically identical cells. They're not only genetically identical to each other, but they're genetically identical to the cell originally that split into two. And also, that moment is the end of this cell cycle and the beginning of the next cell cycle for each of the two cells. So mitosis, therefore, which occurs only in eukaryotes because it's division of the nucleus, mitosis along with cytokinesis make up cell division in a eukaryote. And when the cell division includes mitosis rather than meiosis that we'll study later, that means that one cell splits into two cells that are genetically identical to each other and to the original cell. So genetically speaking, mitosis and cytokinesis results in exact copies of cells. You know, and this is what happened the very first cell division of your life. You started as that single-celled zygote. It underwent mitosis and cytokinesis, so you were then two cells big. But already, every cell of your body, the both cells, had the same library. And, you know, by the time you're born, you're billions and billions of cells. They all have the same DNA library, except for the possibility that some of them might have mutated along the way. And the longer you live, the more mutations you acquire, so that your cells aren't exactly identical genetically anymore, but almost, because of mitosis. Okay, now to six. Well, this gives you just a better close-up view of metaphase, and it also is a better view of this three-dimensionality I was just talking about. They don't necessarily line up. They are in the same plane that's halfway between the two poles of the mitotic spindle, and that's what defines metaphase. The metaphase plate's kind of shown like a glass piece here. It's not really a structure, though. It's just that halfway point. And we can see this is an animal because the centrosome has centrioles, whatever they do. I wish I could tell you. The kinetochores, by the way, you have much better view here. of the fact that one replicated chromosome has two kinetochores, one on either side of the centrosome, which is the place where the two sister chromatids are connected. And each kinetochore is a connection point between it and a kinetochore microtubule from one pole or from the other. And without this connection that happened earlier in prometaphase, it wouldn't be possible for this set of replicated chromosomes to get to the halfway point. In other words, they connect and then they move with the help of these kinetochore microtubules so that they're all halfway between the poles. If you didn't make the connection with the kinetochore microtubules, that wouldn't happen. Well, let's think more about this in slide 7. This shows you the results of an experiment to figure out which of two rational hypotheses is actually true. If you think about, and there's not necessarily two, but there's two obvious ways that this movement of replicated chromosomes could happen using these connected kinetochore microtubules. One is kind of like a fishing hypothesis, a fishing line with a hook, right? You grab the fish and then you reel in the line, and that's what brings the fish to you. So that is one possibility. It would make sense for that to be possible, right? In other words, the kinetochore microtubules are like the fishing line. They connect to the kinetochores of the chromatids, and then they get shorter. They get reeled in toward the centrosome, and that's how they make it to the poles. That's one possibility. That's one hypothesis. Another, though, is more of a roadway hypothesis, meaning that the kinetochore microtubules connect, and then the kinetochore microtubules are not reeled in at the centrosome end. They just are there and serve as roadways along which the chromatid, or now a daughter chromosome really, moves along that microtubule toward the centrosome. All right, either of those could be true. And this shows you the results of an experiment to test which one of those actually turns out to be the truth. So what they did is chemically mark the mitotic spindle, which is really analogous to taking a felt tip marker and making this black band there. Now, if the fishing hypothesis, the hook and line hypothesis were true, then this mark would move closer to the centrosome as it gets reeled in, right? And the distance between the mark and the chromosomes would stay the same, and they would both move together. On the other hand, if the roadway hypothesis is true, then the mark should stay where it is, and the chromosomes should get closer and closer to the mark and eventually pass it. Well, that's actually what they observed, the latter. You can see it getting closer and closer to the mark. Eventually, the mark is no longer there, because what's actually happening here is shown in the bottom. The kinetochore that I keep talking about, that's shown as this green or teal circle here, is a complex of proteins, including these red motor proteins. And we've talked about motor proteins before, right? Walking one step at a time along microtubules. So this is just another use of motor proteins. In this case, though, the cargo is not a vesicle like it was in that original cartoon I showed you. The cargo is the daughter chromosome that split from the other when they were chromatids, right? And the microtubule is simply the roadway. The kinetochore walks along the roadway, getting the chromosome closer to the pole. But this is, unlike most roadways, this is a roadway that's only going to be used one time. Right? You go down a road and it's still there in place for others to use after you're down the road. This only has to be used once, though. So as soon as the motor protein walks along a certain distance, then the road that was there behind it gets disintegrated into the individual monomers that were connected to make the microtubule to begin with. And that's why it looks like it's being reeled in. It's actually getting disintegrated from behind after the kinetochore passes. Okay. Let's go to 8. Did you have a question?
No, I was just wondering about the tubular thing disappearing behind it. Because I was just like, is that like the ATP or the energy that pulls it across? Because that's why it's disintegrating behind it?
No, ATP is definitely used for each step. Mm-hmm. It's just that they are breaking this thing down for raw materials after it's no longer needed as a road anymore.
Okay.
Because you only have to use that road one time for that one chromosome to get to that pole.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, what we have just looked at was mitosis and cytokinesis in an animal cell. And we see that again in slide 8 on the left half. Or actually, what I should say is this is cytokinesis. Mitosis in an animal and a plant cell are pretty much identical, except, of course, that the plant cell doesn't have centrioles in its centrosome, but since we don't know what those do anyway, that's not really an important difference. Anyway, that happens the same way in plant and animal cells. But cytokinesis happens differently in an animal cell compared to a plant cell. And that's the focus of this slide. Remember I said that for an animal cell, cytokinesis involves the formation of a cleavage furrow. And what this shows you is that the cleavage furrow forms because there is more or less a belt cinching off the middle of the still one cell at this point. This is like a drawstring or a belt. Except, you know, normally a belt is worn outside of the pants. The loops are on the outside. Well, here are the loops. Are protein complexes on the inner surface of the plasma membrane, and the belt itself, shown in yellow here, is a long filamentous protein that acts just like a drawstring or a belt, but it's going through internal belt loops. And just like these actin microfilaments that we talked about before can overlap more to make your muscles shorter. That's what's happening here. They form a circle, that's the belt, and that belt overlaps more and more, getting smaller and smaller, cinching the thing inward, forming the cleavage furrow. It gets deeper and deeper until it actually pinches off. And at that point, you have two individual daughter cells that are genetically identical. Now, this is successful for animal cells because, unlike plant cells, animal cells have only a plasma membrane and not also a cell wall, right? And the plasma membrane is flimsy. That's why cells can't survive hypotonicity. They explode, right, because of that flimsiness. Well, that wouldn't work for a plant cell, though, because a plant cell has these very thick, tough cell walls exterior to the plasma membrane. So it wouldn't be possible to cinch it off by forming a cleavage furrow. And no cleavage furrow does form in cytokinesis for a plant. Instead, you see what happens here on the right side of slide 8. This still single cell at the moment has already been through mitosis. That's why you see two separate nuclei in here. Started out with one nucleus, of course, but it completed its mitosis and therefore has two nuclei for the moment. But as part of cytokinesis, what you see forming here, one piece at a time, is what eventually will be called the cell plate. The cell plate, which you can see formed here, is made out of the same stuff that cell wall is made out of. Okay, all of this stuff is the external boundary of this one cell, this cell wall material. Well, vesicles, little bags, form along that metaphase plate, halfway between the two poles. And remember what vesicles are. There's all kinds of different vesicles we talked about, but all vesicles are made out of membrane material, right? So each of these little vesicles, the outside of it, each little vesicle, is membrane material, and then the inside of it is cell wall material. There's many of them forming, and then they get bigger and bigger as more material is produced, until eventually they start hitting each other, and just like when vesicles connect to the plasma membrane, since it's all membrane material, they'll just coalesce into each other. Same thing happens with these vesicles, so that it's all one big cell plate at that point. But these came from these vesicles that are made out of membrane material. So the cell plate has an exterior surface that's the same material as the plasma membrane, which is this, right? But inside the interior of that cell plate is cell wall material. Well, it keeps getting longer until it actually reaches the extents of the cell. And then once again, the membrane material melts into the membrane material of the plasma membrane. And that's when this officially becomes two cells now. Okay, so now you have a plasma membrane right here that's complete, defining this cell, a plasma membrane here that's complete, defining this cell, and in between the two, cell wall. That's cytokinesis for a plant cell. Slide 9 is simply a real photograph of that cartoon. This has been colorized, of course, but you will see this in the lab once we get the scopes to show you these slides, or slides just like them. If you look at, like, typically it'll be the tip of a root in a plant, like an onion root tip. The reason that you choose root tips is because root tips are actively growing in a plant, right? They're a part that's actively growing, and therefore you're much more likely to see in a population of cells some of those cells somewhere in mitosis. So when you look at the tip where that growing is occurring, you can easily just look at hundreds of cells and find an example of each of the five subphases of mitosis. So you'll see pictures just like this. But these are exactly the same phases that we talked about for the animal cell, because as I said, mitosis is pretty much the same in a plant cell as an animal cell. The only thing that differs is the cytokinesis. And this is a good view of the cell plate forming. All right, that's eukaryotic cell division. Slide 10 is not. In slide 10, we have a prokaryote, a bacterium, which of course is a prokaryotic cell. And most bacteria divide or split with a method of cell division called binary fission. Now, binary simply means of two or into two. And fission means splitting. A fissure is a split. So this really just amounts to taking that one compartment, which any given prokaryotic cell is, because it doesn't have compartmentalization since it doesn't have membrane-bounded organelles, and subdividing that one compartment into two. But it's kind of makes something more complex, makes it sound less complex than it actually is, because you still have to do this in a way that involves first cell replication. It has to replicate just for the same exact reason that a eukaryotic cell has to replicate its DNA before it splits, right? Otherwise the two cells can't live. So you have the DNA replicated as a preparatory step. By the way, one difference at this point another difference between eukaryotic cells and prokaryotic cells is that eukaryotic cells have some number, which depends on the species, of chromosomes that are linear in shape, meaning they have two ends, whereas a typical prokaryotic cell has one chromosome that is circular. Not actually a perfect circle, but that just means it wraps back on itself. It doesn't have any ends. It's a loop. So this looks like spaghetti, but it's one big loop before it gets replicated. That one loop gets replicated, and we'll see how that happens in another chapter. That cell, for the moment, has enough DNA for two bacteria, and then it can undergo binary fission to split into two, and each of those bacteria that result are genetically identical, and they replace the now non-existent original cell. By the way, this is how how mitochondria and chloroplasts are created in eukaryotic cells. Remember that the origin of both of those organelles, mitochondria and chloroplasts, is bacterial. There's the endosymbiotic theory that explains how they came into existence, right? They were free-living bacteria originally. And that's why they have their own DNA that's very similar to bacterial DNA. They have their own ribosomes, and they undergo division just like free-living bacteria do. Eleven switches back to eukaryotes as a subject. And the point here is that we looked at animal mitosis and plant mitosis, but of course animals and plants are only part of the domain eukarya, right? There are all kinds of other eukaryotes besides animals and plants. Fungi and all the protists as well also are in eukarya. And what you see here is that mitosis doesn't happen exactly the same way with respect to connection of kinetic or microtubules in all eukaryotes. In animals and plants, which is what we covered, I said that part of prometaphase is the disintegration of the nuclear envelope so that it's not in the way, and therefore the kinetic or microtubules can make the connections to the replicated chromosomes, right? Well, that doesn't happen in all eukaryotes. For instance, in dinoflagellates, which is a different kind of eukaryote, the nuclear envelope stays intact, but it has large holes through which kinetic or microtubules can pass, and therefore it doesn't have to disintegrate. In others, the diatoms and yeast, for example, the mitotic spindle actually forms inside the nucleus, and therefore you don't have to bother disintegrating it either. But in most eukaryotes, including animals and plants, you actually disintegrate that nuclear envelope to get it out of the way temporarily, and then a new one forms at each pole to form two nuclei. That is a natural place to stop as far as subject matter is concerned, and so we're close enough to the end to do so.